I want to welcome Susan Mason, Managing Partner of Align Partners. Susan and I met relatively recently and we had lunch just a few weeks ago. Susan has been at Onset Ventures for 15 years before founding her own venture fund and is a counter example to the memes that you hear in the industry about women don't make it in the venture capital world. And it's always wonderful for me to present these success stories and counter examples. As you know from my writings, I'm not a whiner. I just hate people who whine. And as a result, I love people like Susan who actually do things, make things happen. And also, I have not really seen a lot of whining in the media from Susan. So welcome, Susan. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Sharmana, and thank you again for giving me the privilege to speak to all your entrepreneurs. It's just a great service that you're doing, and you know I'm a big believer in the education process of entrepreneurs and helping them to be even better.
Fantastic. So let's introduce our audience to you and the model that you are, you know, you've come up with that is a unique model. Where did this come from? How you've chosen something different? The current mainstream venture capital industry, in my opinion, is kind of spinning out of control. So let's talk about your observations about what's happening in the industry today and how are you doing something different to counter that?
Yes. You know, it's very interesting in the venture capital industry because I've been in the industry now almost 20 years. And if you look at 2015, right now it is on track to be one of the biggest years of fundraising in venture capital since 2000. So we are back from an industry standpoint, and you're seeing a significant bifurcation in the industry where you have these very large funds on the billion-dollar plus category, and then you have a lot of smaller funds. But oftentimes what you see is the first fund is small, and I would say that as, you know, sub-$100 million category size. And then the subsequent funds tend to balloon back up to the larger one. And the challenge with larger funds is that the fund model is predicated on what I would call the outsized model, where you have three or four companies in a portfolio of somewhere between 25 to sometimes much higher number of companies in the portfolio that will deliver the outsized returns. And effectively, everything else can go to zero. And the issue with that is you have an inherent tension between the entrepreneur who's N equals one, which is his or her company, versus a venture capitalist who takes a portfolio standpoint, and their N equals 25 on up as companies that can deliver the returns. So the issue is the venture capitalist is driven to ensure that they can put more money behind the succeeding companies and start to winnow that down, whereas the entrepreneur is putting their time and energy and really lifeblood into his or her own company and doesn't have that portfolio opportunity. So what we looked at, my partner and I, is because we had been in the industry a long time, is that we recognized a couple things. One is this inherent tension of what is the N equals on the opportunity to succeed. The second item is that starting around 2003, 2004, the amount of capital needed to build a company, and I speak specifically of enterprise-focused companies because we don't do consumer-focused companies, but for enterprise-focused companies, the amount of capital needed to build those companies at least to an exit inflection point that was a reasonable inflection point has just dropped dramatically. And so that opened up a number of opportunities, and we just thought, gee, is there a way to build a fund that can effectively work hand in glove with the entrepreneurs so that you don't have that N equals disparity, but you also can build a company that has an exit inflection point that fits where I would consider the sweet spot range for enterprise companies. And if you look at enterprise startups, venture-backed enterprise startups, most of those exits are in the $60 million to about $150 million. That slides, that range may slide up or down slightly, but that's really the sweet spot range. And so the challenge is, can you build a fund that addresses that and yields returns for the entrepreneur and the early employees versus having the outsized venture model? And so we built Align Partners around that capital efficient model, whereby our companies just need less capital. Typically, our companies take $10 million or less in total equity dollars to reach that sweet spot range of exit points. And we have a number of examples in that category.
So, you know, very much in alignment with the philosophy we practice here is capital efficient entrepreneurship. We encourage our entrepreneurs to bootstrap as much as possible and do things with, you know, not too much money, such that you end up with not very much in wealth creation. You raise a lot of money and perhaps build to a certain amount of scale, but don't really get exits to justify that level of fundraising, which happens rampantly in the industry. And I fully you know, appreciate what you're saying in terms of building things, building businesses within $10 million so that the wealth creation equation actually works for everybody, not just the investors, but also for the entrepreneurs who are putting in years and years of their lives. So we are at a point in history where there's been a lot of enterprise technology that has already been built, a lot has been deployed. So sitting in almost at the end of 2015, fourth quarter of 2015, where do you see the opportunities in enterprise software or enterprise technology in general that you can point our entrepreneurs to, where it's worth building new companies at this point?
I think there's huge opportunities out there, and we continue to see more and more opportunities opening up. The one distinction I just want to get clarity on is we invest typically SaaS model software only. So yeah. It's very hard on a hardware company to build capital efficiency. So uh-huh. In the software area, we see a lot of opportunity in healthcare IT. We think that mm-hmm. marketplace is undergoing a lot of changes. The end customers are looking for new solutions and new ways of doing things. So we see opportunity there. We love fintech, financial services, technology. Mm-hmm. We think, again, that is an area that is ripe for change and is very amenable to capital-efficient types of investment. And we also see within the enterprise itself, the infrastructure, whether that is in the financial enablement within the enterprise, you know, accounting or just the boring areas within enterprise management, supply chain management. We also see a lot of opportunity in security. So we don't see any paucity of opportunity for entrepreneurs. In fact, just counter to that, we see huge market opportunities opening up. And if they can enter those markets in a capital-efficient manner, I think everyone around the table wins and in a much lower risk strategy.
So, folks, based on what Susan just mentioned, the categories, I would like to point you to a few discussions that we've had here in each of these categories. Like healthcare IT is something we have covered extensively, both on the blog and also here in the roundtables. If you want to go back and look at my conversation with Girish Navani of eClinical Works, Girish has actually built a bootstrapped unicorn, 100% self-financed company that is over $300 million in revenue, and you know, really kicking ass in his space. So look that one up. We also relatively recently had Dan Kane from Modernizing Medicine. That's another very interesting healthcare IT company. And that one actually has raised a lot of capital, but is also doing really well in terms of its metrics and numbers. And then in fintech, the company that I want to point you to in the context of this capital efficient enterprise SaaS model is Blackline Systems. Therese Tucker, who's the CEO of Blackline, was here a few months ago. She bootstrapped to a very significant stage, several tens of millions of dollars of revenue, followed by a private equity deal with Silver Lake Capital, and is getting ready to probably go public next year, and is close to $100 million in revenue at this point. And they do basically bank reconciliation for enterprises. So these are just some examples of the kinds of things that Susan is pointing to. And of course, there are, the real trick is to find where is the gap and where are the new opportunities that are going to come from. So Susan, question back, how do you view the issue of TAM? So does your capital efficient model of business building allow for businesses that are more niche but somewhat lower TAMs than what the traditional venture capital industry is looking for? And these days, it's not even a $1 billion TAM, it's like $10 billion TAMs. VCs say without flinching that, oh, we don't invest in anything less than $10 billion TAMs. Well, how many of those are there?
Indeed. Wow, that is such a funny thing. So our view, and goodness, we've seen entrepreneurs come in with the billion-dollar TAM on their slides, and we look at them and go, really, do you honestly believe that? And invariably they'll go, well, no, but we thought venture capitalists needed to see that, and therefore we put that on the slide. So we have had many discussions on this point. What we like to see are companies that have a horizontal platform capability, but can take a vertical approach to executing on that opportunity. And so from a TAM standpoint, we're less focused on the overall opportunity and more focused on the platform capability and then the vertical segments. So let me give you an example. We have a company called SA Ignite in the healthcare IT space. It is a horizontal platform, but the first target segment was around the use case of meaningful use in electronic health record usage by medical practitioners. And so that was the first attack point, and that was probably a $200 million total opportunity. And they executed on that opportunity very well. But the platform itself had the ability that once it secured a beachhead position in that initial use case vertical, using the same customer target, it moved to the pay-for-performance category. And so we are strong advocates of the crossing the chasm philosophy, where you would have what we'll just call M1, P1, which is market one, product one. And we like to see using that product or having that customer base, rather than moving to an M2, P2, which would be, gee, a new market with a new product, we like to see, okay, let's go to a second market but same product, or we say same market but a second product, because stepping across those two areas are the success strategies that we've seen. So even though the initial TAM may be small, what we found with our companies is that as you add up those subsegments and those use cases, you aggregate into a much larger opportunity. But it's not evident from the initial entree. And in fact, those are the types of companies that we really like because they attract less what we would call cheap capital.
Well, and also I would imagine then you can, if you do that capital efficiently, and exit into a large company with the channel that has, like an SAP or Oracle or Salesforce that has all those different verticals that they can access, you could conceivably broaden that portfolio and the acquiring company then gets a lot of leverage out of that platform.
Indeed. What we've seen is that our companies that get acquired, those acquisitions by the corporates The data points we've had tend to be very successful acquisitions. So you don't see these big acquisitions that invariably, I think, on the majority of time fail within large corporations. In our acquisitions, right, our companies get acquired typically between 80 and 100 million. It's less than 6 years. The revenue run rate at that kind of sweet spot position is sub 10 million. And it is a textbook strategy, and we run that on every one of our companies.
Can you talk about a couple of more examples of the kinds of companies that you have invested in, and then give us, you have already started to do that, give us a bit more of the investment thesis on why you were drawn to those companies besides what you've already said?
Sure. Another company that we invested in was a company called Omni, O-M-N-E-Y. And this was a company, the team came directly out of the financial services space. It was actually this team, this particular team, as a cohesive group, this was their second company together. The CEO, this was her sixth company. And so this was a team that hit the ground running. They saw an opportunity where even though the U.S. has what would be considered a pretty advanced banking infrastructure system, the challenge is moving money in real time. And this is a difficult challenge behind the scenes. So this team identified and built a platform that addressed that problem. You could think of it as the express train across the financial backbone that was able to deliver cash in real time. And so what they did, they built the platform, they secured large corporate entities, you know, some of the largest banks actually were their biggest customers, as well as some of the next generation money transfer types of services. They secured that on the outset, and within 15 months, that company was acquired by one of the large credit card processors in the industry. That company required a total of $2 million to execute the strategy. The team owned 75% at the exit. So the founding team and the employees did very well, and again, with less risk, because they identified a unique opportunity, they went in and executed, and then, you know, we could have made the decision of, oh, let's put more money into this company, let's go for a $500 million exit. But the risks around that, once you go out of the sweet spot range of exits in that 60 to 150 million range, the risks go up tremendously for a startup team. And so when we sat down and looked at it, we said, okay, let's take the exit. And now they're building their next company.
Excellent. Excellent. So, folks, those of you who are listening, Susan is providing you some of the mathematics of what you hear me saying all the time is that try not to raise too much capital. Now, it would be inappropriate for me to not call out that one of the most successful companies in our portfolio has raised close to $100 million. And, you know, that's their choice. When we started working with them, they had nothing. They just had a prototype, and we actually did all the validation work before financing. And they went straight to a Series A with $1 million with Accel Partners and has systematically and continuously built customer bases. So today they have over 50,000 global customers. So all that is good. It's not one of the smoke and mirror companies. It's not a Snapchat type of play where there's valuation but no revenue. This is not the reality of the company that I'm talking about. The name of the company is Freshdesk. So I think they will be fine, but to be perfectly honest with you, I personally feel uncomfortable with that level of fundraising because I think it really screws up the equation in many, many, many different ways.
You know, Sharmana, I think the key element for entrepreneurs is just be aware. Make a conscious decision of what you're going to do and truly understand the implications of those decisions. And that's really what we advocate is you can raise as much money as you want, but truly understand when you have a post money of 250 million or 300 million, you need to understand your investors are then going to be looking for well above $1 billion outcome. The number of companies in that category and the number of acquirers are very few. And then you're on the IPO track. And the reality of the IPO track is it is a very small percentage of venture-backed companies that go through IPO. So just our philosophy is just understand the risks metrics along the path, and you make a conscious decision of how you're going to operate.
And what you're pointing out, Susan, is the fact that even though people believe that entrepreneurship is about risk-taking, entrepreneurship, actually successful entrepreneurship, is about calculated risk-taking and risk-mitigating.
Yes, absolutely. And also you have to decide, you know, what are my objectives? If it's the risk versus the wealth equation, not just for yourself as a founder, but for all your employees, because particularly the early employees take the high risk with you as the founders. And so you need to think carefully about, as the company goes on, what are the risk impacts to those employees versus the later employees? And particularly since, I mean, we've been in a relatively high upturn here, and we'll be that market will be changing. We go through the cycle. So the economic cycle is coming up. And just understand the risk aspects of those economic cycles, because you can have a fabulous company, but in a down economic cycle, you're just not going to realize that much cash on the outcome.
Yeah, and we are absolutely going into a down economy. I think within the next 12 to 18 months, we are going to enter a down economy phase for sure, and capital is going to dry up. Investors are going to behave very differently, and investors actually turn on the dime. We've seen this over and over again, that investors behave, you know, in one way in the up economy, and then it just completely, completely switch off in the down cycle. And then a lot of companies with potential are just going to die. You know, if you put yourself on a venture timeline and a venture, you know, burn rate cycle, the likelihood of your dying in the process is very high. Now, if you die, you don't succeed. There's no question. You cannot even, you don't even have a chance to succeed. You have to first survive, then you can succeed.
That's right. The mantra is never run out of money.
Right. So, Susan, I want to, we're approaching the end of your time here. I want to cover one topic before we finish, though. It's a controversial topic, and I am not popular in the industry for the position that I have on this topic, which is the whole women in entrepreneurship, women in technology, women in venture capital topic. So, without saying anything more, I want to ask you what your, you know, high-level observations are on this issue, and then we can double-click on whatever makes sense.
Sure. I think it's a complex issue, and, you know, interesting enough, our fund has no gender lens. We don't care where entrepreneurs come from, what their backgrounds are, and what they look like. And so, interestingly enough, we have had the pick of the female founders / CEOs that we had not expected, frankly. And these are women who are very high performing. They've built 3, 4, 5 companies for other venture funds before. Exited those companies successfully, maybe got a nice gold watch or a nice Mercedes, but didn't really create genuine wealth for themselves. And so we have had our pick of those kind of entrepreneurs, not because we purposely seek them out, but because they're looking for a receptive environment, and I think they just find. So I think it is. It's hard for women to go into some venture groups. But I think in general, my philosophy is that, you know, I guess I would share your philosophy, but no whining is allowed. I don't know if you saw the Tom Hanks show on baseball, which is no crying in baseball. Well, there's no whining in venture. So you got to get over it. And because your customer base is probably reflective of that, given the C-level suites tend to be male. And you have to be able to pitch across all of it. So, you know, I guess I would veer more on your perspective of, you know, pick yourself up and make it happen.
So the other thing that I observe, and I know from your background that you're a ECS, Electrical Engineering Computer Science person, so am I.
Yep.
I have an ECS degree, you have a UECS degree. And a lot of people who are sensationalizing this women in technology entrepreneurship, technology industry issue come from non-technology backgrounds. And I was talking to a close friend of mine who shares the same perspective, as that why are people who don't have the background speaking for us? I don't hear Diane Greene whining and bitching about bias. I don't hear Donna Dubinsky bitching about bias.
So again, I think it's a complex issue. I do think that there is some elements of unconscious bias in the hiring, recruiting, and promotion process. So I think there are ways to address that. I don't think it's training. I think the only way to address that is through technology. And in fact, we invested in a company called Unitiv, which has a woman who's a co-founder of the company, CEO, built a very successful company in the security space before starting Unitiv. And that company executed over 4 years, went from zero to a $300 million exit. So I think there is a way to address some of the unconscious bias that happens. And this is a woman that's PhD math, technical brainiac. But I think the issue is, how do we get more women into electrical engineering and computer science so the pipeline is there? And then
That's right.
Do we help them to be successful in companies? And I think that's the focus item from our standpoint.
Yeah, and then there's a third element, which is people who get into electrical engineering and computer science stay in, because there is this other issue of very talented, very highly trained people, and not just technical women, but women with very high degrees of education dropping out to have families. And
yeah, that's a tough one, because that's all about the partnership, with your life partner of family balance, and it is a juggling act. I know that working moms have to juggle, but if I look across our entrepreneurs, the female entrepreneurs that we have, I would say probably 80% of them have families. So there is a way to do it. I think fortunately they're very organized, they're very directed, and they just execute.